This is an ABC podcast.
This is Baby Talk Podcast with Penny Johnston.
This week, we're going to meet a researcher who went to Africa to study Jane Goodall's chimps with his wife. It's a remarkable story in itself, but from that study and a mistake in planning came one of the world's most loved parenting books, a book that makes sense of some of your baby's most challenging behaviours, an explanation as to why they can suddenly become all clingy and whingy and downright unpleasant to be a parent to.
Why on earth are babies so difficult all of a sudden and out of the blue? Because that's what it is. It's out of the blue, and parents tend to blame themselves and do not think it, you know, it comes from within the baby and it's natural.
Although it doesn't sound like it, this is a lovely story about what's now being called the Wonderwex. And I'd really like to introduce you to Dr. Frans Plooy.
Basically, it's an out of Africa story. Hattie and I went to study chimpanzees with Jane Goodall in the Gombe National Park, Tanzania. You know, we were so fortunate to be part of a group of enthusiastic PhD students that were allowed in the early 70s. And my wife, Hattie, had studied physical anthropology and educational psychology, and I had studied behavioral biology. And we were trained in direct observation of behavior, and we tape recorded the sounds, and we filmed the behavior. And we focused our studies on the mother-infant interaction, the chimpanzee mother-infant interaction, and the behavioral development and the growing independence of the infant. Gombe was unique in the world at the time in that we could observe from a very close range and see all the details of the little babies, because usually they were quite hidden between the arms and the belly of the mother. And without that that possibility to observe at close range, we wouldn't have made our discovery. And we just started observing direct observation in the way that behavioral biologists are trained to do. First, you start with exploratory observations, and then you define a list of behaviors that you have observed regularly. And then you start observing in terms of that list of observations. So when it doesn't happen, when you don't have a record of it, you know it didn't happen. When it does happen, you know how long and how frequently. So it is a way of observing with what we call observational control, because you can easily miss important events if you don't do it the right way. So that's what I did. And then the discovery we made came out of the data, not even in Africa, but when we were analyzing these reams of data back in Europe, this pattern, this phenomenon came out of the graphs we made. You know, we counted and measured our observations, and you make graphs, and then all of a sudden you see the pattern. And so I guess I got lucky. The discovery was that the growing independence of the infant appeared not to be a gradual process, as you would intuitively think, but it occurs in leaps and bounds. And I can't show you a graph now, but normally from birth, the baby is all the time, most of the time, on the belly of the mother, between the arms. And then all of a sudden, around 7 months, the baby would most of the time be still in contact on the body of the mother, but not anymore on the belly. But within arm's reach, in contact. And then a few months later, all of a sudden, most of the time, the baby spent within arm's reach, out of contact, and so on. So this occurred leap-wise. You can compare it with a satellite circling the Earth, and all of a sudden, at some point, the satellite goes to a higher orbit. And then a few months later, all of a sudden, the satellite goes to a higher orbit. But shortly before, or immediately before the jump to a higher orbit, so to speak, the baby showed what we call regression, or a difficult period. It returned to being close to the mother on the belly, clinging on the nipple, and then the mother was a bit irritated and pushed the baby into a higher independence. And then the baby made that jump to a, so to speak, a higher orbit. So that was the discovery we made in the chimpanzees. And part of it was this mother-infant conflict, because the behavior of the baby, of course, was very demanding. Chimpanzees whimper, our babies cry, chimpanzees whimper, whimpering, clinging to the mother on the nipple all the time. So the mother at some point would try to get the baby off her belly and off the nipple. And we have observed, and we made photographs of the mother pushing and pulling and bite-clawing and doing everything to get the baby off. Not always successful, because babies are very strong when they cling to their chimpanzee mother. So it was this difficult period, what we call the regression period, regressing to being closer to mother, the mother-infant conflict, and this causing the baby to pushing the baby into greater independence.
You're the second person that I have spoken to who has taken their study, their observation from apes in Africa to human mother-baby interaction.
Yes, well, you know, they are our cousins and we are related and we are a great ape too, so it does make sense. When we made our discovery, of course, we scanned the literature, and in the same time that we were in the field in Africa with Jane Goodall, a bloke in America had published a literature review and observational studies showing that this phenomenon that we found was present in 12 other primate species, not apes, but monkeys, and even two non-primate mammals. So the phenomenon is widespread in the animal kingdom and goes back at least 80 million years. And then the next question was, if mammals and monkeys and apes do have it, it's likely that we as a human species have it, but we have to show it. You can't just assume it. So when we were back in the Netherlands, we started a study, an observational study in the homes of human babies and mothers. And then we observed not monthly, but weekly, because we had an inkling that the phenomenon was so fast that you need to observe weekly in order to capture the changes. And then we found 10 major difficult periods in the first 20 months in humans. And that's not the whole story, because if you find something like this, replication studies are important in order to be sure that what you found is real. So we found 3 independent research groups in Sweden, in England, and in Spain to replicate our studies, and they did. So then we knew for sure here's a phenomenon that's real. The next question was, why on earth are babies so difficult all of a sudden and out of the blue? Because that's what it is. It's out of the blue, and parents tend to blame themselves and do not think it, you know, it comes from within the baby and it's natural. An independent research group in Scotland has found that shortly before or at the beginning of these difficult periods that we found, major changes take place in the brain of the baby. And all of these brain changes, of course, are invisible to us from the outside, but one can be observed, and that's the measure of the head circumference. If you simply measure the head circumference of a baby, it doesn't grow, increase gradually, but that also goes in jumps. If you would visualize it, it would be for a while a certain size of a skull, and then all of a sudden the skull is a bit bigger, and all of a sudden the brain increases in size with jumps, and these jumps occur just before or at the beginning of these difficult periods.
It does seem like a very good way of explaining fussy behaviour of babies. I know that people say, oh, you know, the baby's crying, it's teething. But you're saying that you could potentially use a tape measure and predict when these things are going to happen.
Yes, that's one of the brain changes that you can easily see and measure from the outside. There are other brain changes that are more physiological and that have been measured in all sorts of studies. If you want to understand why the baby is difficult because of these brain changes, with every major brain change, the baby makes a leap in her mental development. Her perception is changing drastically. There is this new brain tissue that enables the perception of new kind of things that the baby couldn't perceive possibly before. It needs this brain tissue to be able to perceive it. And suddenly, the baby can perceive things that she could not perceive before. And suddenly, so to speak, she is entering a whole new perceptual world. And the keywords here are suddenly and everything that changes. Suddenly everything changes. It's as if your baby just woke up on a new planet where everything he knew suddenly had changed. When I was thinking about that, I thought, well, just imagine yourself waking up on a strange planet and everything is different. I would be frightened. I would like to cling to my partner and take it from there and slowly and carefully start exploring this terrifying new world. Well, and that's exactly what's happening to your baby. It's no wonder they're difficult. They didn't ask for this. They are not able to postpone it or do anything about it. They are just confronted with it like a lightning strike, and there is no escape. So it's understandable that your baby all of a sudden is fussy.
Is there anything then, having made this discovery, have you found a way to help parents help this baby make the transition? I mean, apart from just being understanding that they're now a lot more clingy.
The difficult period, all of a sudden the changes we call leaps, because the study started with leaps into greater independence. But this leap, as we call it at first, is more than this first difficult phase. Each leap consists of three phases. And the first one is this brain change plus new perception plus difficult behavior phase. But then there is a second and a third. And the second is what we call the sunshine phase, with a need to play and learn new skills with mommy. And the third one is the independence phase, with the need to play on his own. Then if you interfere, they push your hands away because they want to do it themselves. They have the idea, now I can do it and I will do it myself. And this second phase, which is in the beginning a few days and later a few weeks after the start of the difficult period, it is a period of adjustment. You will see your baby is happy again, is back to his old self, he sleeps better, he cries less, he eats better, and so on. And the cloudy phase is gone and your baby starts to do nice new things. But he still wants you to be with him while he is mastering these new skills. And in phase three, each leap is now he is adjusted to his new world. He will go exploring and he wants to do it on his own. And research has shown that babies that were stimulated the right way during these wonder weeks, as we call them, are less ill, even in later life, and do better at school. They have better learning results. So it's really, really worthwhile to inform yourself as a parent about the way your baby perceives the world. And here it is that parents can come in and facilitate. And I say facilitate on purpose, because don't take things out of the hands of your baby. Don't do it for them or show it to them. Observe them, see what they're trying to do, and facilitate and understand what they're trying to do from your knowledge of the perceptual world he is in. And when you understand what he's trying to do, and for some reason he can't immediately do it because it's slightly too far away when he's reaching for something, or you can change the circumstances that give him a success experience. You can push a toy he is reaching out for slightly within his arm's reach, or you can, that's what I call facilitating. Don't do it for them, but help them to have a success experience. And you can only help them to have that when you understand what they're trying to do, what they're trying to achieve. And so it's very important for parents that they learn about these 10 new perceptual worlds that their baby is entering, trying to understand what kind of world their baby is in, what kind of goals your baby is trying to reach, and then facilitate it.
So does every baby go through the same 10 in the same order, and do they take different times to reach each step?
Yes, they go through it through the same order, and the ages at which they start being difficult and then enter this new perceptual world are roughly the same. Of course, there's some variation, but the variation is small as compared to the ages at which babies master certain skills. You must understand that this change, this sudden difficult behavior, these brain changes, come from deep down. They are gene-regulated, pre-programmed ages. And the variation there is a matter of days or just 2 or 3 weeks that one baby or the other starts being difficult and starts going through this leap. But then in phase 2 and 3 of the leap, where they start exploring the new world and start mastering new skills, there you have much more variation in the age at which they master a skill for the first time. There may be many weeks or even months to a year that babies differ in the age at which they master a certain skill. And that depends on the opportunities they get when they enter a new world, the examples they get. It also depends on their muscle strengths. Some babies have a heavy skeleton and they need much stronger muscles before they can hold their head upright or make certain movements. And other babies have a lighter skeleton and more quickly, earlier, can master certain motoric skills. So it depends on all sorts of circumstances. And there you find the huge individual differences between babies in the age at which they master certain skills. And those differences in age, these individual differences, have been recorded by developmental psychology for more than a century and is huge. And that's why in the beginning, people were surprised and even disbelievers when we reported this, because they said there is these huge individual differences. So how can this be that the age-linked difficult behaviors have such a small variation? But they were confusing two things. One thing is coming from within, and the other things is how you work it out, how you, with the new ability you have, the new perceptual ability, how you work out the various skills. And that depends on the circumstances, and there you have a huge variation.
So obviously, parents, it would be to their advantage to know when a new phase is coming. Is the main indicator that your baby becomes more fussy again?
Yes. We call it the three C's, crying, clingy and crumpy. And that's it comes out of the blue and is quite all of a sudden as compared to your baby before, because you have mild babies and you have a very temperamental babies. And the temperamental babies let it know loud and clear, and the milder ones are less loud and clear. But still, if you compare your baby with itself as compared to a few weeks before, you know it's more difficult. You know it's sleeping less well. And so you know the difference. And these are the signs that a new difficult period has started.
What happens if, as a parent, you miss the cues and you're not able to help your baby? Babies are quite resilient and they will make the leap whether or not their parent understands what is happening.
Yes, of course. They have this new brain tissue and they work with it. They perceive new things that they couldn't perceive before and they try to work it out. Maybe it's interesting here to talk about another project we did. We developed a parental support and education program. We called it Leaping Hurdles because of the leaps, you know, help babies to leap hurdles. And we had a control group of parents who followed our program, and an experimental group and a control group that followed another program, but not ours. We observed the consequences in the babies and the parents. Mind you, this was done on a risk group. They were mothers who had a difficult, very difficult youth themselves that were maltreated or even abused, also sexually abused. So they had a very, very difficult youth. And it's very well known that we call it the intergeneration effect, that parents who had this very difficult youth, there is a likelihood that they start doing the same thing when they get a baby. So we want to break this intergenerational cycle and give them a new chance. And so it is. We did it with that kind of group. But I have the feeling that if you find effects there, it also applies to normal parents. We did it with this risk group, and we found huge differences between the experimental group and the control group. The babies were intellectually very advanced at the age of 2 years, when we measured all sorts of tests, but they were socially much more open, and they were also physically, they were less ill, and certainly the girls. We don't know why the boys didn't show any difference, but the girls had a very significant effect. And the parents were much more sure of themselves. They were much more tolerant towards their baby. They understood that the baby couldn't help it. The differences were huge. And I tend to believe that this also goes for parents who had a normal youth and who didn't have these difficulties. So it does make a difference when you are told, or when you know what your baby is going through, that you know your baby can't help it, and the only thing you have to do is to support and comfort your baby. And when you know the kind of perceptual world your baby is in and how you can facilitate that. So in these optimal circumstances, the babies learn much more. They were much more advanced later on. We broke the intergenerational cycle. You know, none of these mothers relapsed into the things there is a danger for. They all did very well.
That's great. And I really do believe, as a parent, having an understanding that your baby is going through a phase rather than just waking up in the middle of the night or being more clingy just to annoy you because you're going back to work, it would be a great comfort for parents.
Oh, yes. I think that's also one of the reasons of the great success of the book, because it comforts the parents as well. I mean, by comforting the parents, they are able to comfort the baby. So we help the babies by helping the parents to realize it's not me. It's natural. All babies have it. They can't help it. And this is part of the game. Welcome to parenthood.
Are you able to take us generally through the 10 steps that babies make in that first 20 weeks?
They start, when they're born, they have the ability to perceive intensities and sensations. That's ready at birth. That that developed before birth. For instance, the last major change before birth is around 36, 37 weeks pregnancy. And we believe that's where the perception of sensation starts. So they're born with perception of sensations, and then there is a first leap around 5 weeks, and that has more to do with internal organs and belly problems, that sort of thing. And then around 8 weeks, they start to be able to perceive patterns. And that's not only visual patterns like an abstract painting, but also the patterns can be anything in any type of perception, in any modality. So, for instance, in motion, in the movement, all of a sudden, their movements become jerky, like the ones of an old-fashioned robot. It goes from one position to the other. And that you can recognize it in the way they use their voice. You recognize it in the way they can perceive patterns visually, and they can perceive patterns auditorily. And this is all explained in the book for people who want to know more details. And then at 12 weeks, there is the next leap into the world of smooth transitions. And as far as motion is concerned, then you see that the movements the baby make become more smooth. They don't jerkily go from one position of an arm into another position, but the change from one position to the other is much more smooth. And this goes also for the voice. You can hear them make sounds that are not shockwise. Before, they have sounds that goes like and now they can do with their voice. They can in a smooth way go from high to low and low to high. And parents do it in what we call baby talk, and when they talk to a baby, they go like, "Hello darling, how is your day today? How are you?" And you can hear in my voice that this very, very
sing-song.
Yes, and very exaggerated, going up and down in pitch, high difference between high and low pitch and intonation. That basically, these are all in your voice, smooth transitions, and you catch the attention of the baby because they love it. They can perceive smooth transitions, and if you give a show like this, they love it. So that's why intuitively, as parents, we do it. And that's called in the scientific literature, intuitive parenting, because intuitively, we just try and find out what they like, and it changes with age. And also the jokes that you make later change with age because the world of the baby is changing, and parents find out and they use it. Well, and then the next leap after smooth transitions is the leap of events. And event is not something like what we use as a word for party or something, but you must think of a tennis serve or a golf swing. It's a short, familiar sequence of positions and patterns. So a bouncing ball is an event. It goes up and down and up and down. And it's not the movement from A to B and from B to A, but it going up and down and up and down is bouncing ball. And that as a whole is an event. And we recognize it as an undivided event and not two or three separate movements. And then you get around half a year, the leap into the world of relationships. And again, you shouldn't think of the boy-girl thing and social relationships, but very, very simple things like the positions, the distance between objects or the positions that objects have to each other. For instance, one block you can play with is behind another block or before or above or under or next to or into. If you put a block in a box, into this above, under, before, behind, into relationships between objects. But also, of course, the distance between mother and infant. If you consider mother and infant to be two objects, there is a distance between them. And that's a relationship, the distance between. And the interesting thing is that from that age onwards, babies show what was called in the literature attachment behavior. All of a sudden, when you go away, they protest, they cry much more than before. And that was called the onset of attachment behavior. Well, it was the onset of the ability to perceive relationships and to perceive the distance between mother and baby and the wish of the baby to control it and not to lose control over the distance to its mother. So if you look at the behavior of the infants and you know that this ability to perceive relationships is underlying everything they can do, you understand all of these things much, much better. And then the next one is around roughly 8 months, the ability to perceive categories. And categories are things that have a number of characteristics in common, like a dog is a category. You have many different dogs, but you have a general concept dog. And so they start learning about the world in terms of categories. We call them categories. You can also say concepts. So what is a table? What's the difference between a table and a chair and one dog and the other dog? And so in that period, it's very important, for instance, that you go out with your baby and you walk a lot and you see and you hear a lot, because it will allow your baby to give your baby the opportunity to learn about the many, many differences between things and what certain categories have in common. And you can only learn that when you have lots of experiences. So take them out, take them to an animal farm. I don't know how you call them, but we call it Kinderboerderij, which is a children's farm, where they have a number of farm animals and they can approach them. They can, you know, like a goat and a cow and a pig, and they can stroke them and they can touch them. And they learn about animals and at least farm animals. So give them experiences, and they are working like hell to learn all these categories. And then the next one is sequences, around roughly 10 months. Sequences is that one thing happens, one event, for instance, happens after another. Examples are that they understand at some point that first you have to put the key in the keyhole and then turn it around. That's a sequence of two events. And the whole world is full of sequences, and they have to learn a lot. And then around roughly 1 year, they go into the world of programs. And a program is more than just a sequence. It's, if your program, for instance, is washing dishes or laying the table or dusting a table, you can do it in a vacuum cleaning is a program. Looking for your glasses that you lost is a program. You can do it in many ways. There are many ways to roam, but still it's the same program. You can first dust the legs of a chair and then the surface you sit on, or the other way around, but still it's a program dusting, or it's the program washing dishes. So it's a network of decision nodes, we say it, where you say, okay, I've done this, now what? I've done something, and now what? And you can, through this network, you can, as I say, many ways to roam. You can do it in many ways, but it's still the same program. And then the next one is around roughly 15 months, they enter the world of principles. And now they start to be able, because they are one step above the level of programs, they start being able to start programs themselves and choose between programs. So they can choose whether they will do a program or not. They are not caught in it. Other principles, very simple ones in the household, are if you are eating, that there's a rule that everybody is at the table, and you only start when everybody's there. And you can't just start before everybody's there. Simple rules like that a baby can understand. It's also the age, as far as social principles are concerned, that you can start giving rules to babies, that you can demand that they stick to certain rules, however simple they are at that age. At this age, if you don't do that you can spoil them. And we always say you can't spoil a baby, but you know, a 15-month-old is a toddler. It's not a baby anymore.
Sure.
They are able to perceive principles and social rules. So in a very simple way, of course, not overdo it, you can start demanding something from them. And if you don't, they are searching for these principles, and they push the limit all the time until they find it. And if you don't give it to them, they will go on and on pushing and crossing the border, because they want to know everything about principles. They are searching for it because they can perceive it and they want to understand the world. We always say, who better can give them these rules than somebody who loves them? It's just like your baby has a right to get food. Your baby has a right to get rules, because food is a need, or otherwise they are hungry. And they also have a need for knowing about principles and a need for rules. And if you don't give it, they starve. So to speak, they have a right to get rules, and it's not that something you can't ask from them. It's something they have a right to get. And then finally, at the age of 17 months, they enter the world of systems. There are very complex examples of what is a system, but first of all, a system is your own body is a system. And so they start recognizing themselves as separate from other people. They get a notion of self, because self is a system, and they start to understand that. But also a system is, for instance, a football club, or the parental house, or things like that are also a system. And they start to understand that they have a family, and it's different from the family of their friend. If they are in the friend's house, when they are playing there are other rules than in their own house. And so they start understanding this. And these are just a few examples. It's very complex. And if people want to know more, they really have to read the examples in the book. So this is it. 10 times, 10 different worlds, perceptual worlds, with all the consequences it has, all the facilitation and support they need from you.
That's fantastic. And Dr. Franz, just to make it even more accessible, I believe that you've developed an app for phones as well.
Yes, well, we try to get this message across to people in all possible ways. In the past, you published a book and that was it. Nowadays, a printed book is just one channel to get your message across. So, of course, apart from printed books, we started ebooks, and at some point we said, well, with this new world, apps are a very important part of nowadays of people's world. Let's make an app where very briefly is indicated what it's all about. Of course, if you want to know more, you really have to read the book or the ebook, where you have all the information. But it gives brief summaries of the leaps, and also gives the ages, and also you have a leap alarm if you enter the due date of your baby, not the birth date, but the due date, which is important. Then you get a warning: your baby is about to enter a new difficult period or a new leap. So it's a small service to people, and a brief summary of what it's all about. It's not on its own, it's not enough. It's just to alert people that it's there. If you want to know more, you really have to dive into it.
I think it would be such a thrilling thing, though, to have an alarm to watch out for something about to happen.
Yeah, well, when the app wasn't there yet, people would say, parents would say, because we had already a website and possibility for people to ask questions. And we started that in 2000. And it was very, very primitive website in those days. But at least we tried. And I found myself late in the evening, 11 o'clock, talking through the website, typing through the website with a woman in the Dolomites in the north of Italy, because she was desperate and didn't know what or how, and I could comfort her and make clear it wasn't all that bad. So that's how it started.
So parents who have used the leaps and tried to facilitate them for the babies as best they could, they have seen the results into childhood and teenagers?
Of course, it's nice to see what happens beyond the first 20 months and if the leaps still go on. We didn't collect data on the consequences up till the age of 5 years yet. The thing we did was this experimental leaping hurdles program, where we measured the differences between the experimental and the control group at 2 years. And we found the huge differences there. We tend to believe that this continues and goes on, and that you also find differences later on. If you read and listen to the comments that parents make, and there is lots of contact through the website and forums all over the place, the effects are quite important.
Did you end up having babies with your wife? Did you have them before or after Africa?
No, after, because having a baby in Gombe is quite dangerous, because the chimps, if they get a chance, eat them. So it's, having a baby there was quite out of the question. Jane Goodall herself, she had her first child, and his nickname was Grub. And when he was, I think, 1 or 2 years old, he was there. But they built a cage for him on the beach. Next to her house, he could play in the cage, but there was a cage to protect him from the chimps.
So, wow, that's incredible.
So we got one daughter after we got back to Europe.
How, being an anthropologist, what was the observation process like for your own baby?
Well, at the time when she was born, we were still analyzing the data, so we didn't know yet. And so we were also calling our mums and say, Mom.
I love it. Yeah, that's how wonderful.
Because, science takes time, and we were still just counting and tallying the results. And the whole pattern hadn't emerged yet from the data, so we were quite ignorant. And, of course, when it came out, we would say, oh, yeah, of course, that makes sense. So we were as ignorant as most parents are, and that also made it more easy, I think, to write the book, because you understand where everybody's coming from. We understood very well how useful it would have been to have known what we knew then.
Dr. Franz Ploy from The Wonder Weeks. It's a great book, a website, and now it's even a smartphone app as well. The Wonder Weeks, and hopefully we've gone a little way to explaining some of your baby's less desirable behaviour, but at least now we know there's an excuse for it. If you've just discovered us, Baby Talk, we're a weekly podcast and we love talking about the latest research and information about babies, toddlers, pregnancy and fertility. We love tracking down the answers to questions or story ideas our listeners have, and often that's through joining us on Facebook. ABC Baby Talk is how we're found on Facebook, on Instagram and Twitter. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and on the ABC Radio app as well. Baby Talk is also found on the ABC Radio website. Just drop ABC Baby Talk or Baby Talk into your search engine and you should be able to find us quite easily. I'm Penny Johnston. I'll see you next time on Baby Talk.
ABC Baby Talk is a weekly podcast on ABC Digital Radio, wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app. Like us on Facebook to find out as soon as a new episode is ready. Just search for ABC Baby Talk.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.